Greetings and welcome to the Science Podcast for November 4th, 2011. I'm Stuart Wills.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This week, the selective advantages of living on the edge of range expansion, the threats of North Korea's Chiangmai Pekto volcano, and the influence of social networks on brain structure. Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Humans have spread to occupy most of the world. But what demographic forces actually shape a population as its range expands? With three centuries of church registries at hand, a team of researchers based in Canada and Switzerland looked at that question in Quebec's Charlevoix-Saguenay-Lac-Saint-Jean region, a particularly well-documented example of recent human settlement and range expansion. The team found evidence that people living on the leading edge of the expanding range of settlement, the so-called wavefront, enjoyed a selective advantage in populating the settled region. The researchers also offer some speculation on how these differences may have contributed to the evolution of certain human traits. One of the corresponding authors, Laurent Excoffier, spoke with me about the findings from his office in Switzerland.
So globally, we were really interested in spatial or range expansion, so when a species expands its territory. And this kind of problem is difficult to study in long-lived species, and it is especially difficult in humans. So we have realized that actually we could use some genealogy that existed for a specific region in Quebec to actually study this range expansion in real time, so in time and in space. And so we could use this genealogical information to actually follow in space and in time this progressive spread of populations in this region of Quebec, this Charlevoix-Saguenay-Lac-Saint-Jean. And so after having studied that, our main result is that we show that actually the individuals that live at the edge of this range expansion on what we call the front of the wave of advance have actually selective advantage compared to individuals that are in the core of the range.
Well, let's step back and set the scene a bit. You mentioned that you were looking at the settlement of the Quebec region. This was, I guess, after 1686, and in particular at this wave front that you mentioned. Can you talk just a bit more about the actual region you studied and what we mean when we're talking about the wave front?
Actually, we studied this region of Quebec, this Charlevoix-Saguenay-Lac-Saint-Jean. Well, because it's a very well-documented range expansion that started around 1686 from Quebec City, and people progressively settled along the St. Lawrence River and then went into the Saguenay-Lac-Saint-Jean regions in a very progressive way. And so for us, it was really a very well-documented and progressive range expansion. So that's why this region really got attention. And moreover, in this region, we had very precise information on the genealogies of the individuals having lived and reproduced in that region. So it was really an ideal place for us to look for these spatial expansions. And we were really interested in this wave of advanced dynamics. And there are other studies who have showed actually that this edge of this range expansion, what we call the wave front, is very important for these dynamics. So that's why we were interested in this wave front. And the way we define this wave front is because actually, we had information about the time of the settlements of all the localities in this region, and so we could very precisely define this wavefront as the set of localities that were settled in the last generation. And so we could really follow this actually moving front for about three centuries.
And this was all made possible by the genealogical records you were studying, I think, and I seem to remember there was something like a million records that you looked at. What sort of records are we talking about, and what were you digging for specifically?
Actually, we got records from the church, so we used parish records. And the church at the time really recorded extremely well when people got married. And actually, we could count that there were more than 88,000 marriages that occurred in this region of Quebec from 1686 to 1960. And so we could actually, from these parish records, trace down all the individuals that are descendants of these individuals that got married. And so in the end, we got a database of more than 1.2 million people that actually descended from these 88,000 refugees and that either stayed in this region of Quebec or they moved somewhere else in Quebec.
Wow.
And so we got information on all the individuals that lived in that region, their place of birth, date of birth, the name of their parents, the date of their marriages. And from this information, we could actually reconstruct all the genealogies. But actually, this work had been done before by some database in Quebec. So there is a database that records actually all this information for the last 30 years, actually.
So you started out with at least the data in digital form. I guess one of the first things that stood out, if I'm understanding the paper correctly, is that people living in these settled regions today, their ancestors tend to be people who were on this so-called wavefront, this leading edge of settlement. How did you determine that?
We could see for each of these marriages and these individuals where individuals actually reproduced, where they had their children, and we could actually compare this information to where the wavefront was standing at different times. So for each individual, we could infer whether it reproduced on the wavefront or not. And so what we have seen is that in the region of Saguenay-Lac-Saint-Jean, more than 45% of the individuals actually reproduced on the front, and 35% reproduced one generation away from the front. So 80% of the ancestors of all the individuals living now in Saguenay-Lac-Saint-Jean either reproduced on the front or really just one generation away from it. So it really shows that it's really an important region for those people.
And I gather that you've sort of related this to different patterns of the fertility of women between the wavefront and the core, essentially the number of women, of children born to women over their lifetimes. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. So actually, since we were a bit interested in this wavefront, so we got interested in the demography, the differential demography of this region compared to the range core. And we realized that women on the wavefront actually started to marry earlier than women on the core, which allowed them to have, on average, a bit more than one child more than women on the core. And so this represents about 15% higher fertility than women on the core. And we also realized that these women had 20% more married children than women on the core. And this number of married children is very important because it's a much better measure of the effective reproductive success of a woman.
So in other words, the fact that the children married meant that they were creating children of their own, and so in terms of passing the genetic imprint down, that was important.
Yes, actually these women on the wavefront actually could much better transmit their genes just because they were on the wavefront compared to women that remain in the core.
But where things really get interesting, at least to me, is that you're suggesting that this higher fertility on the wavefront of settlement is actually a heritable trait, that this wasn't just a sort of, a more neutral process, but that natural selection was actually at work here.
Yes, that's quite interesting, because we could actually measure this number of children per woman and measure the same thing in the children of these women. And so what we realized is that there was a correlation in the number of children between the mothers and their offspring. And that's what we mean by heritability. So this trait, women fertility, is heritable. And we've shown and we've seen that actually this fertility is heritable actually both on the wavefront and in the core. But when we look now at this a bit more efficient way to measure reproductive success, which is the number of married kids, actually, this trait is only correlated between two generations on the wavefront and not in the core, which means that this trait is heritable only on the wavefront. And this is interesting for us because when a trait is heritable, it means that it can be evolving through natural selection. And so that's why we think that actually that's a very interesting result, that actually this fertility can evolve actually on the wavefront and not evolve in the range core.
Well, so we have a very provocative and interesting observation and interpretation here. How would you sum up the larger significance of what your team is reporting for, you know, for studying human population movements or even other species? And are there any next steps here?
Yes, actually, even though we cannot be sure that this phenomenon happened for all range expansions, but we would probably say that expansion of social communities that are a bit similar to what we had at the time. So farmer communities actually could have had a bit the same kind of dynamics. We could imagine that similar processes actually could have happened during these Neolithic expansions. And these Neolithic expansions lasted for much longer than what happened in Quebec, so maybe 5,000 years in case of Europe. And so we could imagine that some traits could also have evolved during this range expansion, and not only fertility, but maybe other traits that actually we could still have in our character somehow. So, and one of these traits that we could imagine to have evolved is maybe just human curiosity, because if you think about it, somehow humans tend to want to always look over the next mountains, and actually such a trait would be very likely to have evolved during this kind of range expansion. And so we cannot know for sure, but since we find that some human traits have evolved during range expansions, I mean, some others could also have evolved during those times.
Laurent Escoffier, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you very much.
You can read the paper by Laurent Escoffier and colleagues at www.scienceexpress.org.
Today, Changbai Pektu volcano is marked by a misty mountaintop housing an innocently azure crater lake. But only a millennium ago, this sleeping giant exploded, blanketing thousands of square kilometers in ash and pumice in what was one of the largest eruptions of the past few thousand years. Located on what is now the border of North Korea and China, this volcano is showing signs of coming back to life. Science's Richard Stone accompanied two British volcanologists to the volcano's flank in North Korea and talked with me about the country's monitoring systems and plans to foster international collaboration. Here's Rich Stone.
The story is about probably the most dangerous volcano which you have not heard about. This volcano is right on the China-North Korea border. The Chinese call it Changbai. The North Koreans call it Pektu. And this volcano was responsible for one of the biggest eruptions in the last 10,000 years. So scientists are quite concerned. They want to know what is the potential for this volcano to reprise the very large blast that occurred approximately 1,000 years ago. The other interesting aspect of the story is that I accompanied two British volcanologists to North Korea, and we visited North Korea's research stations at Mount Pektu. We're the first Westerners there. So it was quite a thrill.
So you were the first Westerners to have gone to this volcano. Can you just step back and just give us a few impressions of what it was like to travel through this, you know, somewhat mysterious country and to get to this volcano?
I think the reason that we were allowed to go is that the North Korean scientists take the threat of Mount Pektu very seriously. And they have approximately 200 researchers who study Pektu, but they have very limited technology. So they're working with pretty antiquated equipment. What they need is support from the broader international community. So they reached out to the two British scientists, Dr. Clive Oppenheimer, University of Cambridge, and Dr. James Hammond, now at Imperial College. And they invited them to help them assess the risk. Now, I got to tag along, which was a really special opportunity. And the three of us arrived in Pyongyang on September 8th. And the next day, September 9th, was North Korea Founding Day. So it was the 63rd anniversary of the founding. And they had a big parade, and we were guests in a grandstand where we could see the leader, Kim Jong-il. And so it was really a special opportunity, very rare glimpse into life in this fairly closed nation.
Wow, it sounds like an incredible opportunity. So let's go back to the volcano. And so you were on the Pektu side in North Korea. What do scientists know about this volcano's history, its early origins?
Well, the volcano itself is something of a mystery because there's a lot of debate about why the volcano actually is there, because most of the volcanoes are either right along the plate boundaries. So you have quite a number of volcanoes on the so-called Ring of Fire, and you have a second set of volcanoes which are formed by mantle plumes. Now, the Changbai Pektu volcano is 1,200 kilometers roughly west of the Ring of Fire. So it's called an intraplate volcano. And the reason why it's there is really not clear. So one of the advantages of studying the volcano from both the Chinese side and the North Korean side is you can map the volcano and you can peer inside and you can get some finer resolution imagery that may help answer the question about how Chanbai-Pektu actually works. So that's one key point. The other key point that scientists focus in on is that there was a massive eruption about 1,000 years ago. And now most people, I think, are familiar with eruptions like Krakatoa. The Chanbai-Pektu eruption from approximately 950 AD was much, much bigger. So it's particularly intriguing because you have this intraplate volcano, which itself is not quite clear what drives it. And you had this huge eruption 1,000 years ago. So it makes it very hard for scientists to assess the risk of a reprise of this very large blast. You know, what are the odds it could actually happen again? And the way to better assess the risk is to, again, have finer detailed studies of the main magma chamber and to try to better assess whether magma is rising toward the cone.
And so what has this volcano been doing recently? What has brought scientists back to look at it once again?
Well, the last eruption of Chanbai-Pektu was in 1903, and it was not a very big one. It's been relatively quiet since then. There was a series of seismic swarms, so shaking of the mountain, from 2002 to 2005. So there was a lot of seismic action going on. And a lot of scientists believe that this was a sign of magma moving closer to the surface. But then that activity stopped suddenly. And for the past 6 years, it's been relatively quiet. Now, they've seen some geophysical changes that they can't account for. There's been fluctuations in the temperatures of hot springs. There has been a change in the direction of the ground motion from southwesterly to southeasterly. So that's basically a 90-degree twist. So researchers are puzzled. There's something going on here. Some scientists believe that Chanbai-Pektu is building up to its next eruption, and they say, we really have to be careful now. Other scientists think, well, you know, it's pretty normal for a volcano to go through changes. I mean, the land does change, and there's no reason to be particularly alarmed now. But everybody agrees that the volcano needs to be closely monitored, and there's a possibility that the North Korean researchers may be brought into an international collaboration that can monitor Chanbai-Pektu from all sides. So you have 360-degree coverage that way.
So what are the major hazards of this area should this volcano erupt? Should this be a major eruption?
Well, there are two main hazards. Even a moderate eruption could trigger huge lahar. So that's a combination of water, rocks, mud that would be sent down a valley. It's the only outlake to the volcano's lake. This valley lies on the Chinese side, and there's about 60,000 people or so there. So even in a moderate-sized eruption, you would have a disruption of the Mount Pektu Lake. That could be quite dangerous. Now, if there's a major eruption, you know, on the scale of the eruption from 1,000 years ago, then that could put many more people at risk. And the main problem there would be probably pyroclastic flows. So pyroclastic flows are super hot gas and rocks, which flow very quickly. And the pyroclastic flows from the eruption 1,000 years ago carved valleys that are 120 meters deep. It was huge. So both on the Chinese side and on the Korean side, they would have to be quite concerned about that possibility. Now, for intercontinental travel, there would possibly be a very large ash cloud, as what happened with the volcanic eruption in Iceland last year. So that would affect travel. And if it is a major eruption, there could be a possibility of a slight global cooling. This does happen when the ash plume is quite large volume. So these are all potential effects. And most of these effects would only occur if it is a massive eruption on the scale of what happened back in 950 Common Era.
Presumably, you know, our understanding of this volcano was really affected by the fact that it's shared between two different countries. So what's the future of collaboration between North Korea and China and with the rest of the international community?
Well, I think the signs are very promising because there was a German researcher in the early 1990s who visited North Korea, did some field work. His name is Hans Ulrich Schmink. Since Schminke did his field work in 1993, that's basically been it. There's been some limited collaboration between North Korea and China. Some Chinese geologists have collected samples there. But in terms of real hardcore geophysical studies, what may be happening in the coming year, there could be really a new era here where there's talk about the Chinese earthquake researchers coming to do joint collaboration with their Korean colleagues. Clive Oppenheimer and James Hammond are planning to return next summer for some real field work. I mean, their trip in September was basically a scope out what the Koreans needed and, you know, try to plot out how they could help. I think the real collaboration is going to start up next summer.
Well, Rich Stone, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Carrie. Thanks for having me on the show.
Richard Stone writes about North Korea's Paektu volcano in a News Focus article this week, which also includes a photo slideshow documenting his trip. Which came first, an expanding brain or greater social skills? According to many, it's bigger brains that allow some animals to be more social than others. But according to a paper published this week, the size of some parts of the brain may in turn be influenced by the size of an individual's social network. Jerome Saleh and colleagues used magnetic resonance imaging to scan the brains of rhesus macaques and found that the number of individuals in their colonies correlated with the sizes of the parts of the brain known to play a role in processing social information. Furthermore, the team also uncovered a relationship between brain structure and an individual's ranking within the social totem pole. Saleh spoke to me about the findings from his office in the UK.
So our study addressed the question of whether social environment could impact on the brain structure and of functions. And to answer it, we collected structural and functional MRI scans from rhesus macaques that have been living in social groups set to different size. We found a subject comparison of MRI structural data that revealed that living in larger groups caused increase in gray matter volumes in brain regions in the temporal and in the prefrontal cortex. Furthermore, analysis of the functional MRI data revealed an increase of the coupling of the activity between some of this region. We then concluded that social network size contribute to changes both in brain structures and function, and those changes may have a potential implication for an animal's success in a social context. Indeed, gray matter differences in the mid-STS, the superior temporal sulcus and infratemporal region, as well as in the rostral prefrontal cortex, were also correlated with each animal's dominant status within its social network.
So, in a sense, this was almost a sort of a chicken and egg question, that there have been these studies in the past that show that brain size affects our social networking, but here you were looking at whether or not our social networking affects our brain size. So how did you decide to tackle this question? Can you describe these rhesus macaques that you used and what variables you took into account when you studied them?
So the animals we studied are rhesus macaques. They're from a research facility where they are housed in social groups of different size. And the crucial parameter in our study is the fact that the size of the social groups are controlled by researcher. The animal sociability did not determine it. So that gives us the opportunity to answer the question of the chicken and the egg. And in addition to a social network size, we also look at various parameters, including the age, the weight, the sex of the animals. And as I said previously, in a subsequent analysis, we also consider the relative dominant status of 14 male macaques and were living in social group of the same size.
And so these macaques were living in social groups of different sizes. How long had they been living in these groups? Was it their entire lives?
No. So the monkey were coming from a breeding center for various reasons, principally the fact that they had to work with different research groups and the monkey were assigned to learn different tasks. This parameter leads to reorganizing the monkey in the research facility. And the monkey were scanned sometime after this reorganization happened on average was a year after this reorganization was done.
So you had these monkeys that were living in social networks of different sizes, and you scanned their brains. So if we could jump right into what you found, you identified a number of areas of the brain that do correlate with social network size. What do these areas of the brains do? What are they responsible for?
So first of all, we observed changes in the temporal cortex, more specifically in the supratemporal sulcus and the adjacent inferotemporal cortex. And neurons in this region are known to be sensitive to faces and body movement. Changes were also observed in the amygdala, which is a subcortical nucleus known to be involved in emotional responsiveness. And we also observed changes in the prefrontal cortex, in the lateral rostral prefrontal cortex, in the anterior cingulate sulcus, as well as in the dorsal lateral prefrontal cortex in the area 9. The precise function of this structure in social cognition is relatively unknown. There is some evidence that the activity of the dorsal lateral prefrontal neurons is modulated when choices are made in the context of an interactive game and by the relative dominant status of different individuals when they are competing for food. And the hypothesis we proposed is that the rostral prefrontal cortex region we identify might be a precursor of the human prefrontal region known to be associated with the ability to infer about others' minds, also known as the theory of mind.
And so I suppose a limiting factor then is that we don't know everything about the brain of these monkeys. It sounds like you can't quite infer that every part of their brain corresponds directly to the same part of the human brain. Is that right?
Yes, it is.
So you mentioned earlier that you also compared the dominance ranking of these macaques to their, you know, the anatomies of their brains. So what sort of relationships did you find when you pursued that?
So we performed a second analysis in which we look at the effect of the relative dominant status on brain structure. And we performed this analysis because we were interested in trying to find out whether the changes we observe in correlation with social network size could somehow reflect how successful an animal could be in a social situation. And so what we found in this second analysis is that in the temporal cortex and in one prefrontal cortex region, we found a correlation between gray matter volumes and relative dominant status of the animal. And in this region, we had previously found a correlation between gray matter volumes and social network size. So based on those results, we suggested that changes we observed may have potential implication for animal success in a social context.
So you've now uncovered relationships between the size of social networks and social rank with all sorts of different parts of the brain responsible for social cognition, recognition of faces and voices. What are the most salient points here to retain about the evolution of primates in this regard? And maybe does this have any implications for humans in the way that we interact now?
So the key point of our study is the fact that the social environment could have an impact on the brain. And previously I've shown that learning a new skill could also induce brain plasticity. For instance, if you teach a monkey how to use a tool or if you decide to learn how to juggle. The other important point is some of the effects we found in our study could be linked to some studies done previously in humans, where they showed that alteration of brain structure that correlated to social network size, both in the amygdala but also in the dorsal prefrontal cortex. This is a study by Bicot and a colleague recently. So it seems that there are some similarities in the brain structure involved in dealing with social information in the British macaque and in the human brains.
All right. Well, Jérôme Salle, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
You can read the paper, Social Network Size Affects Neural Circuits in Macaques, in this week's Science.
Finally today, Daniel Strain of Science's News Department is here to fill us in on some recent stories from our daily news site. So, Daniel, first, another solution, or maybe multiple solutions, to a sort of mammoth mystery from the past.
Yeah, this is actually a very, very old paleontological mystery, what killed the mammoth. And actually, according to this new study, it's a bit complicated, kind of like the murder on the Orient Express.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about that extinction first.
One of the fascinating things is it wasn't just the mammoths. So about 50,000 years ago, this was, you know, sort of right smack dab in the middle of the last ice age, you started to see these pretty massive extinctions of a lot of big mammals. So not only do you have the woolly mammoth, the very iconic mammoth, but you have saber-toothed cats, ground sloths, and steppe buffalo, a number of different animals as well, started to slowly dwindle, and then many, in fact, wound up dying off completely. Humans for a long time had been fingered as one of the possible culprits behind this demise. People weren't really sure, and this new study actually kind of gets to the bottom of who's responsible.
Okay, so humans have normally gotten a lot of this pinned on them. What did this team do to try and look a little bit deeper at that?
Well, they not only looked at humans, but they also looked at sort of how climate change might have played a role. So they did pretty broad surveys. They looked at where climate was changing around the periods that we see these animals disappear. Then they also looked at archaeological data to see where humans were at the same time. They also made some basic assumptions about just how diverse these animal populations were as well.
And so what was the result of all of this multivariable kind of analysis?
Well, exactly like Agatha Christie's murder mystery, there seems to be a lot of different people responsible. So in many cases, the scientists think that climate change seems to be largely responsible. They point to the case of woolly rhinos. They disappeared completely from their homes in Eurasia about 14,000 years ago. But it actually turns out that they grew pretty significantly when humans first sort of entered into their range. So these researchers think that humans were probably not the single driving factor and that climate change instead was.
But I take it that humans played a bigger role in other areas? Or?
Yeah, the other case would be steppe bisons, where we seem to be a lot more at fault. These species seem to slowly go extinct about 35,000 years ago, and that seems to be largely related to climate. But then about 16,000 years ago, when humans entered where the steppe bison live, that rate of dying off just started to skyrocket, and these animals really started to circle the drain. So the scientists seem to think that it was climate change sort of started things going, and then humans really, really kicked it into gear.
Well, what about the most celebrated case that you alluded to at the start, the woolly mammoth?
Yeah, unfortunately, the case of the woolly mammoth seems to still be fairly complicated, and researchers still aren't particularly sure whether or not it seems to be mostly humans, mostly climate change. Some other researchers have pointed out that there could be a lot more going on than either human hunting or climate change, and that other things might be involved as well.
And next, a story about Viking sunstones. What exactly might those be?
Well, no one's really sure what a sunstone is exactly. It's something that's referred to in a lot of Viking literature, but we just don't know. It presumably helped the Vikings to navigate their stormy seas around their homes.
So how do the legends say these sunstones sort of help them navigate?
Well, the big problem facing Vikings is that, as you know, these folks were pretty big mariners. They had to get to various places to pillage and to explore about 1,000 years ago, and they mostly navigated by sunlight, just telling where the sun was. And that's fine, except that these Vikings lived pretty far in northern Europe, and that a lot of the times the weather was very cloudy, and you can't navigate when the weather is cloudy. So people have often wondered how they didn't just get horribly lost.
And these sunstones were supposed to help them with that. Now it looks like a team of scientists is claiming that these sunstones might be some sort of calcite crystal. Is that right?
Well, their sort of hypothesis is that calcite, which is sort of a very basic prism that you'd be familiar with, is involved. And as folks who've played with prisms know, calcite crystals, they have this very interesting property that they split light. And these particular crystals basically cut light in half. So light coming in gets just divided and turns into two images. Now, how this might actually help people like the Vikings navigate is that on a cloudy day, you still have these rings of sort of polarized light that circle the sun in layers. And presumably, if you have something like a calcite crystal which can split the light, you can actually find out where those rings are sitting and then where the sun is.
Well, it's a nice model, but how could you really establish that that's what the Vikings were doing?
And this is the actual very fun part about it, is these researchers actually went out and they did their own test. They made one of these sort of hypothetical sunstones, and they actually took it out in a boat on a very cloudy day. And it turns out the measurements that they did were very accurate, actually within 1% of where the real location of the sun is.
So even on a cloudy day, they were able to sort of judge where the sun was using this quote-unquote sunstone.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's important to note that no one, archaeologists, haven't really found a sunstone of any kind on any of these Viking ships. So at this point, this is all sort of in the realm of fantasy, but it's an exciting one.
And finally, to end on a decidedly upbeat note, it looks like happy people live longer.
Yeah, this actually shows that that song, Don't Worry, Be Happy, might be practical advice for for living a long time. What this study found, actually, is that older folks who tended to have more positive outlooks also tended to at least appear to live longer.
Well, I guess one of the problems is, you know, how do you actually assess that someone has a positive outlook? How do you actually measure that?
And that's actually a really interesting question and a difficult problem for researchers. When you ask people in retrospect, it turns out that they tend to maybe seem a little bit more every cloud has a silver lining than usual. They tend to grade their problems in sort of relation to, you know, all of the other problems that people are having, and they tend to be a little bit more hedging their bets and being a little bit more optimistic.
And so this study did something different?
They did, actually. What they did is they actually followed a group of about 11,000 50-year-olds and older and had them actually report about 4 times a day just what their emotional state had.
So they're doing it in real time.
Doing it in real time, yeah. Whether or not they're anxious, worried, happy, content. And so it turned out that the results are pretty startling. So the people that had reported the least positive outlooks, about 7.3% of those happened to die within the next 5 years.
And what about the people with more positive feelings?
And actually, it looks like that the people with more positive feelings, that rate was cut down by about half to about 3.5%.
Wow. But I mean, I guess if somebody was going to die within 5 years, they might have been near death anyway and have good reason for being unhappy. I mean, how could something like that be factored out?
Yeah, there's a lot of sort of confounding factors there, not only in sort of a person's health, but also in other things that may determine how long you live, your wealth, your educational status. So they looked at a lot of those variables and they actually took them out of their analysis. Even with all of those variables taken out, a person's health status and everything, the happiest individual had a risk of dying within the next 5 years that was about 35% less.
But this is just a correlation, right? I mean, presumably we still don't know if happiness is the cause or the effect in some sense.
Yes, it's definitely not a smoking gun, but the researchers do point to the fact that an emotional state or well-being can play a pretty big role in health and sort of argues for better social support and economic support for seniors.
Okay, Daniel, what other stories are you looking at for the news site?
Yeah, we have a new look at a new paleontological find of a saber-toothed squirrel. And another story looking at how cleaning up old cells in the body of mice can actually seem to help them for age-related diseases. And then on our policy blog, Science Insider, we have a story examining a report that looks at how fracking off the coast of Great Britain actually may have caused an earthquake. And finally, on our weekly online chat, Science Live, we have a great discussion on the signs and dangers of asteroids with orbits that bring them close to the planet. It's set to coincide with an asteroid that's going to be coming very close to the Earth on November 8th.
So we'll all have to keep our eyes open.
Absolutely, yeah.
Daniel Strain writes for the Science News Department. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. And that wraps up the November 4th, 2011 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Stuart Wills.
And I'm Carrie Klein. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.